Welcome to Listen In. I'm Brian Gahan, and this podcast focuses on the stories that are buried deep inside all conversations. Be it the kind of conversation you have with someone whose life experience is full of interesting POVs and insights, or the kind of conversation you have inside your own head around your own life experiences. Today, in episode 9, I'm talking with Jay Ferguson, a Canadian film and content producer. In part 2 of our conversation, Jay goes deep into his love of travel and how having the world as a creative playground can be inspiring, challenging, and ultimately rewarding. Whether he's writing an exotic location into a script or putting his hand up first to go, Jay has always been eager to take his storytelling talents around the world. Hey, Jay, welcome back to Listen In.
Thanks for having me, Brian. And I think I did much better on this one because I actually responded when you said hello.
Yes, it's a trick, right?
I'm learning. See, I told you I'm always learning. Well, this is me learning the process.
Well, I'm glad to have you back because last time we were talking a bit about Guidestones and how you got involved in that type of storytelling. But the thing about Guidestones that I thought was interesting is how much travel you did and how much location shooting you did. You know, which then takes me to your whole career of shooting in India and, you know, shooting all over the planet. You've been in a number of different places. So let's just talk about some of those stories. Let's talk about some of those interesting places.
One of the great things about this business is that you need to go to the place to get it, right? Like you can't really shoot Toronto as India, you know, unless you have like millions of dollars and you can, you know, create a whole set or whatever it is. But it's like at the budget levels that I work at, you need to go to the places to actually shoot them, to actually see them, to get them on camera. When I first started out as a cinematographer, I would like, literally, if the project was a project in some other country, I would shoot it for free, right? Just to go there. It's like, buy me a ticket and put me up and I'll go anywhere. And if you like to travel, it actually can be a really great way to see a bunch of the world, you know?
Well, I would imagine, because, you know, the little bit of traveling that I've done in, you know, in commercial making, you just get so deep into the culture, you know, because you're working with locals, you're moving around in places that are more location driven than even safety and, you know, tourist driven.
Yeah.
You come back, you might have only been somewhere for a few days or a week, and you come back feeling like you've just been submersed in that culture.
Yeah, I mean, that's a thing too, is that it's like, there is this kind of like thing about when you're in the film business that kind of, it's, I don't know what to call it, it's like a pass you get, because it's like, you're going to come and film it, and it's like, so we're going to give you access to like the things that nobody else can have access to. I'll give you an example of it. And this isn't exotic in any way, but I remember we were shooting a film here in Toronto, and we needed, like, there was a character who was a senator. And so we needed a senatorial type, location. So we went to the city of Toronto and we said, we need, you know, like these sort of hallowed halls of like columns and whatever. And it was like, so we got basically to like go everywhere. Like that was like, we were at Queen's Park, touring around Queen's Park going, okay, well, we could use this hallway, we could use that. And I remember it was amazing because, and this was very early in my career, it was like, we got this like private tour. We were standing in the legislature of Queen's Park looking at it. I mean, we weren't going to shoot in there, but it was kind of like we walked past it and I was like, hey, can we go take, oh yeah, sure, come on in, we'll go take a look. And it was like, suddenly it's like you have access to all these buildings that you as the public can't just walk into and say, I want to go wander around Queen's Park. And it was like, we went in and it was like, yeah, okay, if we want to shoot here, on that same project, we needed a place, a location. And we went out and looked at the like Harris filtration plant out in the East End. And it was like, and you know, we got a private tour of that place. It's like, oh yeah, we could shoot here. We could shoot there. It was like, and it was like, this is amazing. I actually thought that, you know, it's kind of one of those things that if you wanted to like go to a city and you just, even if you weren't making a film and you kind of went and said, I'm making a film, I need to look at these locations. You could get these private tours of all these amazing places that nobody else can go to because they think you're going to come and shoot something there. Anyways, I feel like it's
I think
like,
you've just started a trend.
That's right. Oh my gosh. Don't do it. It's a terrible thing to do. You'll ruin it for the rest of us. No, but it is, you know, the other thing too about it is that when you go somewhere, you're going to capture the essence of a place, hopefully visually. And so you go to like the most amazing places, right? Because it's like, you're not going to go to Prague to shoot all the stuff inside an apartment. Right. You know what I mean? Like it's like, you could do that here. You're going to go to Prague and you're going to set the scene next to the river. You know what I mean? Like yeah. You're going to set it, like you're going to use that stuff. And so for me, that's what's so great about it is that you're always going to end up next to something iconic. I mean, not always, but like a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Because why are you going to go all that distance and not capture that? Mm. In fact, actually, there's a good story of it. I remember you and I working on a project where we were shooting for a company that was a Canadian-based company, an Ontario and Quebec-based company, and we were shooting outdoors, and we were supposed to shoot winter. So we had to go to South America because it was summer here. So we had to go down to Bariloche in South America in order to shoot these sequences because we needed winter. We needed snow. But I remember going down, it was like, well, we have to shoot it like it looks like Ontario. Now we're going into Patagonia. We're going to like the most beautiful mountains in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And the plan was to shoot it to look like Ontario, which is just like basically some trees and snow.
Very flat.
Yeah, very flat. And I remember we were both like fit to be tied that we were going into the most incredibly beautiful place in the world, one of the most beautiful mountain ranges in the world, and we were going to shoot away from the mountains. The client was great because in the end, the client said, no, let's take advantage of it. You know, it doesn't have to be just Ontario. It could be British Columbia as well. It was like, okay, great. And suddenly we were shooting these incredible mountain ranges and you and I were both like then finding the most amazing places to do these shots. But the fact was, is that it was the first time in my life where I was like, we're traveling to the other side of the world to not shoot the scenery. And it was like, I remember thinking, this is insane. Like, what are we doing? Anyways.
Well, the humor in that is that it's budget related, right? Like we could have faked snow in August in Ontario with a huge budget, but because we didn't have that much money, it was cheaper for us to fly to Argentina where there was real snow. But the caveat was you can't make it look like it's not somewhere in Canada. Or you can't make it look like it's not in Ontario. And so the restrictions got smaller and smaller. But I think it was the second time that we went down, they said to us, no, it's okay. You can show the mountains. Because they realized like, yeah, this is crazy that you're not bringing that part back with you.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, to me, the travel is amazing because not only do you get to see things, but you get to see them from a very intimate point of view. And often, look, you're still working when you're there, but you can like go to this iconic location and spend a day or two in this place and you get to know it, you know?
Welcome back. I'm talking with Canadian film and content producer Jay Ferguson, who's sharing what he loves about traveling to shoot in new locations and the unique POV that is created by being to a place for the very first time.
I remember when I was a film student, when I was first getting into film, so many of my cinematography heroes were from Europe, and they came to the United States and they became these incredible cinematographers and filmmakers as well, directors. I think that that happens a lot because, you know, you come and you see a world that you didn't know. You see it from a different perspective. So I truly believe that, you know, when I go out and I shoot Toronto, I mean, I'm in many ways shooting Toronto like a Torontonian, but it's like if I go and go to a city that I don't know, it's like you see all the stuff. Like, I love shooting in Europe. Like, to me, shooting in Europe is so much fun. And it's just like the architecture, and it's like how you can, you know, the bridges, the cool things that like we don't have here. And it's like, oh man, like I just want to frame everything up, you know. It's like so I mean, one of the things that I developed, and especially on Guidestones, was this kind of method of shooting out in the world and traveling with a crew on a very, very, very tight budget. Guidestones, we had no money, and yet we traveled all over the world shooting. And so what I developed was a system of like 4 or 5 of us traveling, maybe 6 of us traveling, very key core group of people, and a couple of them might be the lead actors. And then show up in another country with often a small crew there, a fixer, some equipment, and some local actors too, possibly, if we needed other actors, other roles, and that we would go out, and the idea was that we would scout. I would always show up at the location beforehand and at least get a couple of days of scouting in with a fixer and saying like, and then picking the locations based on not their need, not there being a need for all this equipment and lighting and all this stuff, but to like actually choose the locations that kind of sort of almost take care of themselves in a way,
right?
You know, like find these incredible, whether they're interiors or exteriors, that have beautiful lighting already, natural lighting, and then go in with this tiny crew and then shoot them fast enough so that you could take advantage of the light that exists or you know, the spaces that exist. And that also comes in the writing as well. I would design them. I would write them specifically so that they would, you know, so they were shootable in a quick period of time with a small crew.
That's incredible. I mean, the amount of skill set in that is incredible, right? Like, to be able to write something, crafting it in a way, knowing exactly that I'm going to be using limited resources, therefore I need natural light, I need consistent light, I need this, I need that. That's something that I think it's a skill set that gets developed over years that people would not know or take. They would just take it for granted. They think like, they look at that shot and go, yeah, well, he just got that shot.
Yeah, no, it's totally true. And the preparation too. Like, it's funny. I remember I spent a lot of time when I'm writing a project, I spent a lot of time on Google, on Maps, because it's like, I will literally do location scouting from my computer, and it'll be like, okay, so I need a church across from a lake or whatever it is, you know, because these two moments have to happen. So it's like, then I'll spend a bunch of time like on Street View looking for that location potentially. And sometimes I'll find it and sometimes I won't. And then you'll have to talk to the fixer if you have somebody say like, this is what I'm looking for. And then sometimes you have to adapt as well. But the fact is that it's like, you know, if I find something, then I can maybe adjust the script even to work for the location. you know, if you have a unlimited budget, then you could just say, okay, well, we need this, so we'll just build it, or we'll, you know what I mean? Or whatever it is that you can do with money. But when you don't have money, you need to be prepared and adaptable.
So a couple of times, I'm just going to jump in here. Sorry to interrupt you, but a couple of times you've mentioned the word fixer. So for the listener who's not sure what that is, when you're traveling in these foreign countries as a filmmaker or storyteller, you use a fixer. What is that?
A fixer is a person who is basically the one who puts your local operations together. So if I was a fixer in Toronto, I'd get a phone call from somebody from wherever, another part of the world, and they say, we want to come and film a commercial in Toronto. We require these four locations and these three actors and this crew. And so me as the fixer, I arrange all that stuff. So I make sure that you have a hotel to sleep in when you come. I make sure that there's options for you in terms of local actors, locations, equipment. I find out, it's like a production manager, but I think we call them fixers for some reason when they're in a different country.
Well, I always thought they were called fixers in a different country because they also know how to fix the problems that you come up with local.
Totally.
Customs, security, hey, you're not supposed to shoot here or be here or whatever.
Well, actually, I think fixer is a really telling term because you're right. It's like, because it's, you know, you could be just like a manager. But the thing is that in this business, it's just all problems, basically. It's like you're a fixer because you're just fixing problems.
Right.
I mean, I would say that you could almost call a director a fixer in some ways because you're just basically troubleshooting from the top of the day to the end of the day. You know? So, yeah, but it's like that's what the fixer does is it's like you say like, okay, because like in our business, it's always like the most ludicrous stuff. It's like you're saying like, you know, yeah, I need a parrot that is got no blue on it and, you know, can like fly upside down because that, and you know what? And the fixer will find it, you know, that's the crazy thing is that, you know, like we were doing a project not too long ago and we needed like an orangutan and whatever. And it's like, you know, the fixer found an orangutan that could be trained to do a certain specific thing. And it's like, because that's what you got to do. It's like, this is, there's always, you know, something required.
Yeah, I remember when we were in Argentina shooting him and there was the snow guy, you know, and he was also a multi-talented, lovely man who was very creative in many fields, made instruments, did all sorts of things. But one of his specialties was he was the snow guy, and it was like he's the fixer brings him in because, oh, you're shooting snow. And
he was incredible with snow.
Yeah.
Like this guy knew how to, like, it's like you'd say like, okay, we need this, the snow to do this. And it was like, he'd figure it out, you know, it was like amazing, you know?
Yeah. So you're always wondering like, you know, like, yeah, where does that come from? Like the ability to be able to problem solve the world's weirdest problems, right?
Well, and that's what makes this business really interesting. I mean, this business in many ways is infuriating, but it's also allows you to do some pretty interesting things, like for instance, the snow guy. You know, the snow guy. It's like he was interested in snow, clearly, and he knew how to manipulate snow. And so it was like, okay, in one situation, there was a shot that we were doing where it was like it had to be in a puddle, and the puddle had to be in the middle of the forest where there's no puddles, you know?
Right.
And it was like, so the snow guy figured out how to give us a puddle in the middle of a forest that where there should be no puddle, you know? Yeah. And it was like, and the shot was amazing, right? And it was just like, and then later on in the day had to figure out how to do something else with the snow, you know? And so like, if you're a creative person and you like challenges, then this is an amazing thing to do.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Canadian film and content producer Jay Ferguson, who's talking about shooting in India and the challenges of low budget, stealth shooting, and thinking on your feet to get the magic done.
One time we were shooting in India, and we're shooting in a marketplace called Chandni Chowk, which is like one of the biggest markets in the world. And the place is incredible. It just bustles with humanity. It's like, I don't know what the numbers are, but on any given day, there are like tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people that go through this marketplace. And it's a series of winding buildings that kind of go on forever and ever and ever, it seems. And it's just these narrow corridors. And so I set a scene in the center of this. And it's not the kind of place where you can just lock off a location and have, you know, have your way with it and say, like, you know, we'll bring in a bunch of extras and whatever. We didn't have the budget to do anything like that. So what we did was we just shot the scene in the middle of the marketplace. And so I took my two actors and basically said, okay, so we're going to go here. We blocked it. So, which is like basically stage the scene. So it's like, you'll walk in and you'll stop here and he'll stop there and you'll have this dialogue and then you'll move on and go around the corner, whatever it was. And it was a short scene. It was like maybe 20 or 30 seconds long. But, you know, so we get ready and we go to shoot it, and we're still, you know, we're small, compact crew. But there's still, you know, seven or eight of us, and we go to do our first take, and, you know, we have the slate out, and there's a sound person with a boom, and it's like we're just drawing attention to ourselves. Right. And we go out and we roll the cameras and the slate goes smack, and it's, of course, everybody stops and they're like, you know, all the people in the market are like, well, what's going on over there? And, you know, we don't even get 5 seconds into the scene, and already the whole background is filled with like maybe 30 or 40 people staring down the barrel of the lens. Like, this is instantaneous, you know.
It's like breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah, exactly. It was hard to believe that you were in the story at this point with all these people. So it was like, so, you know, we would ask people to step aside, and it was like people were very polite and they would move, but then other people would just fill in the space, you know. It was like this flow of water. It was like impossible to stop. So it was like, okay, so these people are just going to stand here and watch us, basically. And so what are we going to do about it? So on the day I was like, okay, all right. So let's go hide. We're going to do our crew. We're going to go hide around the corner. We'll wait a couple of minutes. And then, when we sort of felt like the coast was clear, we would, roll the cameras, do the slate all around the corner, and then we'd all kind of sort of sneak into position and then let the actors come in and do the scene. And so that worked for about 10 seconds. And so about 10 seconds into the second take, then the people all started showing up, and not the same people, just different people. And it was like staring at the camera and going, what's going on? And why are these two people arguing? And it's, of course, it was a spectacle, and there's a camera person and whatever. Okay. So we do this. So then we go and hide again, and we did this several times, but we could probably only get about 10 seconds, 15 seconds into the scene. So then once I felt like we'd gotten that, then we went back and hid and then went out and did the second half of the scene and the exact same way. But it was like this total stealth shooting. It was like, but I got to tell you, if you can watch that sequence, it's beautiful, you know, and it's like, and it's genuinely like there's hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of art direction and extras in this stuff. It's like just amazing, right? It's like, wow, I can't believe it. And we did a lot of that, especially in India. I mean, in terms of having to get stealth stuff, because right. It was like, you can't block it off and recreate it at our budget level. I mean, certainly you can at another budget level, but that's not our budget level. And so it was like we figured out interesting ways of doing it, you know.
Well, and it's probably a better end result, because you end up with the real thing in the background, not somebody's interpretation of what it is an Indian market look like.
Yeah, it really is totally legitimate. And the stuff that I love is the stuff where the people are, for the most part, going about their daily lives and aren't even paying attention because they're in their life. And it's like, there are like, in that scene in particular, there's a couple of like crosses of extras, people going by, like cross meaning like somebody going through the frame or walking past the actors, that are like, it's so amazing. Those people have no idea that there was anything going on. They were just going about their life. And it's like, it's so legitimate. Like there's no extra that you could get to do that, you know, like it just doesn't, it wouldn't happen. It just looks like an extra walking through.
Yeah. Like the brushing up against them closely or coming a little bit too close to their space where an extra would be like, I don't want to bump them. And you'd get the real deal.
Yeah. And you can see that that extra, I mean, what would have been the extra is like, would never, like the performance is absolutely brilliant because it's like, they're worried about like getting this thing from A to B. And you can tell just by the way they're moving, which is like not at all what you're going to get for the most part out of an extra who has to do this 47 times, you know? Yeah. And so we defaulted to shooting, this was part of the stylistic for that project in particular, but it was like, I used a lot of long lenses and small cameras and shot it through stuff. So it was, I wanted the visuals to be very voyeuristic because it was a thriller. And the idea is that these people were always the protagonists were always being watched somehow. So I really played into that aesthetic in terms of visually. So, but that also played into us being able to go into public places and shoot stuff. And it made sense visually and creatively, but it also made sense because then we could hide cameras. We could, you know what I mean? We could actually be like behind something and shooting. And actually we had this. So here's a great location story. Or you can be the judge of whether it's great or not. Here's a location story. So I had written a scene to take place in New York City under a bridge, like right near the Brooklyn Bridge. I sort of knew this little area, but I'd scouted it out. I knew exactly where I wanted to be. And I wanted to shoot the scene right there by the water under the Brooklyn Bridge. And because I wanted a certain skyline in the background and I wanted this all lined up. And so we were shooting sequences in New York. We were in New York for a week shooting sequences for season 2 of Guidestones. And this one scene, I was like, this is where we're going to do it. And then when we were going to shoot in New York, we went and we had all these specific locations that we had to shoot. And so we shot them, but then when it was our day to shoot that scene under the Brooklyn Bridge, the day before, or maybe it was 2 days before, or maybe it was even a few days before, but we found out that there was going to be like this crazy snowstorm was going to hit New York City on that day. And it was like, we couldn't shoot the scene out in a terrible snowstorm because it had to tie in with the timing of all these other scenes that we were shooting. So there couldn't be snow. So I was really worried about the snow. So what I did was I thought, okay, so how do we move this scene inside? And the thing was, is that it was kind of a blowout argument between the two main characters. They're supposed to have this big fight. And it kind of needed to be in a big open space, right? It needed to be a place where they could, you know, it couldn't be, you know, in a coffee shop, right? It had to be somewhere like, that's why it was like outside in the middle of the city where they're yelling at each other and they didn't have to contain themselves. So I was thinking like, how do I put this scene somewhere else other than outside and in a giant snowstorm? So I thought, what about Grand Central Station? What about in the middle of Grand Central Station? But it's like, you don't just go and shoot in Grand Central Station, right? It's like, this is like, anyway, so actually, so this wasn't, so what I did was I was like, okay, how great would it be to shoot in Grand Central Station? What are the chances? So I called up the city of New York, that is the incredibly gracious city actually to shoot in. And I said, this is my situation. I'm coming from Canada. we're going to get snowed out. We're coming down specifically to shoot this stuff. Like, what are the chances of us shooting a scene in Grand Central Station? We'll bring no lighting. We're going to do it totally guerrilla style. We won't disrupt anything. And they were like, they said yes. They basically said, you can have the place. You can come in and shoot for 2 hours between this time and this time. But no lighting, no whatever. And it was like, that's fine. We can do it without it. I mean, it's such a beautiful, incredible building. And it was like, I'll just find a way where the light is right and we'll shoot it super quick and we'll shoot it guerrilla style and we'll get it. Totally gracious. They let us say, gave us this 2 hour window. It was like amazing. So we showed up and we got there at the time and we just started shooting. And we used these long lenses again because it was the style of the show. And we were shooting and what was amazing is that we're there. So our two protagonists are in the center of Grand Central Station, which is busy as anything. We're shooting this argument and it was like people, like New Yorkers are the best. And it was yeah. like at one point some woman came up and started saying, you know, she started getting upset at the guy for like fighting with her, you know, and he was like, you leave her alone. It was like protective. There was a protectiveness, right? And people were not afraid to come up. And it was like, and the actor's like, no, we're actually shooting. Look, the camera's over there. And the poor woman was like, oh, okay, all right, you know. But it was like we literally had these things where people were coming in and stopping this argument from happening. It was incredible. So we shot it very quickly. We shot the scene in 2 hours in the middle of Grand Central Station. And it was like way better than under the Brooklyn Bridge, like way better.
Right.
It's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, and we're in Grand Central Station. I mean, I wouldn't even imagine it. And it was because the people in New York totally took mercy on us.
They get it. They get it.
They were like, okay, like these people are coming from Canada and they're going to shoot all this stuff. And there's this crazy snowstorm that we're all aware of. Okay, go ahead. And we were totally like by the book. We didn't bring out any lighting. We used the, you know, we found the available lighting that worked really well and blocked around that. And the two actors who were playing the roles were incredible. And they did such a good job, especially in this kind of chaotic atmosphere where we're like, just go, you know,
have a fight in public.
yeah, exactly. And it was like, just go do it, you know? And they were great. They were amazing. And it was like uncontrolled, but it's like, you just like, kind of, there's an authenticity to it that is like so real that you just would be really hard to recreate. You know, yeah. It would take days to recreate that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So tell me, okay, you were talking about crowds in India, you're talking about snow, but I also know in Guidestones you ended up in Chernobyl.
That's right.
So talk me through that of crazy location scouting or just even.
Right. So I wrote into that season that there was this whole part of the, so it's a thriller, so there's this conspiracy theory and there's all this stuff that's supposed to have happened, and so I wrote the whole Chernobyl meltdown was part of this conspiracy. So there's a town just outside of Chernobyl. Like, so there's the Chernobyl plant and then there's a town, I believe it's called Pripyat, and it's like about a couple of kilometers from Chernobyl, but it was like the closest town. And it was this incredible city that was built basically right near Chernobyl. And then when it was pretty brand new when it happened, when the meltdown happened, and this place was basically ground zero after the meltdown. And so everybody was like, basically, like buses showed up and just got the people, like basically the town was abandoned. Basically, right. It was like, we got to get everybody out of here. And they got everybody out of there. And then it just was like left. And it was like this idealized, like Soviet city of like, you know, with an opera house and like the playgrounds. And it has this iconic Ferris wheel, which mm-hmm. is still standing. And it was like this whole town was just, it was relatively new. And then it was just suddenly abandoned. And of course, nobody is allowed to go in there for decades. And so I had found out that you could go there. You could go visit it. And so I built it into the story. And then we went and we shot there. And it was an incredible experience. So you know, we had a fixer, and this is in the Ukraine. And so we had a fixer, and we talked to our fixer, and we were like, this is what we want to do. And she was like, okay, we can arrange that. So we took our crew and our cast, and we went, and we shot this sequence in the town. And we actually ended up going and visiting Chernobyl, the plant, as well, like, which I wasn't expecting, actually. But it was like suddenly we finished shooting this day and we're driving out, and we like ended up like going. And I was like, wait, that's the Chernobyl power plant. And it was like, yeah. And it was like, can we go? And it was like, of course we can go. And so that we went and stopped, and like we were looking at the Chernobyl power plant, and I was like, this is crazy. Like I was not expecting this. But In the town that we were in the town that had been abandoned, we basically had just free reign of that place. And so I just started shooting. I just was like, okay, let's get the cameras rolling. Let's get the actors. And we just spent several hours wandering around this abandoned town, going in and out of the buildings and shooting them coming through. And it was like, I had sort of a list of things, because it's not a place you can check out beforehand.
No.
And
no.
So I knew that I needed to get them sort of from A to B. And so we shot tons and tons of stuff, and of the actors going through. The one thing that I always remember about shooting in that location was, one, our fixer had a Geiger counter, which is never necessarily a good thing, right? When the fixer has a Geiger counter and turns it on and goes, see, these are acceptable levels of radiation. You know, it wasn't like there's no radiation. It was acceptable levels of radiation. The thing that goes through my mind the most is something that our sound guy said, is that he said to me, at the end of the day, he said, you know, sound people are so hyper aware of every sound around, even the stuff that you know maybe is not even going to be heard. They're like, really, a good sound person is like really all about the sound and making sure that there's no bad sound when you're trying to record dialogue. And he said that it was the quietest place he's ever heard in his life. Like, usually when you're outside anywhere, there's like sounds of birds, there's sounds of life, right? Like there's sounds of something going on. And he said it was just dead silence. Wow. There was nothing. And there was like trees, and it's like an abandoned city, right? Like there's trees growing in the buildings. It's like, but there was nothing living there. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And I think that you could see that, but the fact that there was no sound, even the things that usually are alive and creating some kind of sound, like that didn't even exist. Yeah,
they're all just gone.
It's everything. Like it was just dead. It was pretty
that's eerie.
Intense. Yeah.
That's very intense.
Yeah, very intense.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Canadian film and content producer Jay Ferguson, who's sharing his love for shooting in France and some of the challenges faced when you step out of the safety net of your own culture. And I know you've shared with me a lot of the work that you've done in France. And I also know that you shared with me sort of a moment of, and I'll throw it out at you, and then I'll let you tell the story and maybe and talk about what it did for you, because as a creative person, as a person who's in charge and making things happen, you know, we're always, you know, having to work with our self-confidence, and we're always having to work with like our, you know, are we imposter syndrome, or are we good enough, you know, how did we show up here? And there's nothing worse than when you're the director and you realize there's this crew of, you know, not in maybe in this case, but in some big productions, there's a crew of 50, 60 people standing around all looking at you, waiting for you to do what you do. And you're like, not even sure you know what you do, right? So you told me about working in Paris and learning that the French don't have back doors to their homes, to their apartments, Do you remember that story?
Oh, I'm trying to remember. For some reason, I don't know why. Give me another hint.
So you said to me that you set up and blocked a shot in an apartment, and the people, the French crew's there. You're speaking to them in French, and they're saying to you, "Well, the person can't leave that way." And you're like, "Well, yeah, sure. They just went out the back door."
We were making this project in Paris, and I was setting up this whole thing. So first of all, you have to understand. So this was an interesting experience for me, because I had these. I'd been working in France for a little bit, or with French partners on English language projects, and I was starting to get to create this community in France of filmmakers and actors and people, and I was starting to become friends with a lot of these people and collaborating on different things. And so some of my French friends came to me and said, "We want to do this French language project, and we want you to direct it and produce it with us." And I was like, "You're crazy, because my French is just, sort of." And they were like, no, you can do it. You can do it, because I could speak some French. So anyways, I immediately went and enrolled in French classes and I started taking French classes every week. And I was practicing my French because I was so scared of directing in French, a crew and actors. Although the main people involved were very supportive. And so it ended up going okay. But I remember there was a time where I would make assumptions. So this was a very Parisian story, and it was the story of a relationship, basically, between, a couple, and they're very urban, and it was a comedy, and it was all about Paris and, Parisians going to psychiatrists and really gritty, I don't know how I was directing it. It's like, what do I know about Parisian lifestyle? But it was anyways, it turned out really well. But the fact was, is at one point I was just I was blocking something, and I said well, they'll just go out the back door. And they're like, and then the crew, and there's this whole crew, and it was a substantial crew. And they were like, "Well, there aren't back doors. There's just the front door." And it was like, "Oh, what do you mean there's no back door?" It's like, there's always a back door, right? It's like, and I was bringing my Canada-centric, young country with big houses and front and back doors to this Parisian world, which is you have this front. I mean, I would set things up. Sometimes I would set up shots. And this is funny. It's like, you have to find your confidence, but I would sometimes go and set up a shot, and people in the crew would come over and they would just look kind of mystified at what I was doing. And I'd be like, "Well, yeah, because they're gonna walk out of that building, and then this guy is here, and they'll come and do that." And they're like, "Nobody would ever do that." And it was like, and I was like, "Oh, I had no idea." Yeah. I had no idea. And they're like, "That would be nobody in Paris would ever watch that and believe that that could actually happen." And it was I mostly got it okay, but every now and then it was very, very difficult. It was hard to know.
But that's a great lesson, because then you're going to, you as you move forward, even in Canada, you're shooting something and you have to ask yourself, would a 17-year-old move, do that, have that hand gesture? Do they open their phone and use it the same way as a 50-year-old does? It's great to be able to have that kind of spidey sense, to be able to go deep into that. And so that's, the benefit of that is to never, ever, ever just make the assumption that, of course that's how it's done,
Yeah, totally. It's exactly that. It's what we take for granted, say, "Oh yeah, they'll go out the back door." No, there's no back door. It would be and the result of that would have been everybody in the audience would have gone
Yeah.
Why is that person still in the apartment? Yeah. It's like, it's like, why? So where did that person go? Into the bathroom? It's like,
why are they now talking on the phone?
Yeah. It's like, well, no, we're just all going to assume that they just went out the back door.
Well, I got my first exposure to that years and years and years ago. I wanted to make a music video. That was my, sort of a step into that genre. And we're, it's film days and we're set up and we're on a rooftop and we got the artist is on another rooftop in this urban center and he's dancing. He's a reggae artist. And I'll never forget it. Like we set up and with the lenses we had and everything. And I was like, it's not quite close enough. We need to be like just a foot closer. And so my DOP at that time, he was like, okay, no problem. And then he rolls the film for like 5 seconds, 10 seconds. And then he stops and he turns around to the crew and says, okay, we got shot number one. It's now shot number two is about a foot back. And I realized he was protecting me. He was making sure that the crew understood I knew what I was doing. Because why on earth would have I set everything up in that location that we were in if I didn't want that to happen? And it's so important when you're working with those types of large crews to be able to maintain that confidence. So to have something as poignant as, what do you mean there's no back door? I've always loved that story. It's such a great story.
I got to tell you another quick story.
Yeah, sure.
We were shooting a sequence in, I was really excited about this sequence. And as I said, we were on super tight budget and we didn't have really, many resources, and we were shooting in London, and the opening of season two of Guidestones takes place in London. And, what happens is that, the protagonist is like picked up by a couple of cops and put into the back of a police car and questioned. And so it was kind of fun. We were like, we had a police car. So we rented a police car and some police uniforms, and we had hired a couple of local actors to play the cops. And we were on this very busy downtown London, street, where what happens is that the protagonist sort of goes across. She's a bit dazed, and she goes across. She's almost hit by a bus, and then the cops see her and go and like talk to her, and then they end up putting her in the back of the car, and she's she shouldn't be talking to the police anyway. So we have this whole sequence that we have to do that, like, when you think about it, it's like fairly complicated, and we're sort of kind of stealing it. Now the thing is that, so when you're shooting anywhere in the world, not anywhere in the world, but in most places in the world, what you can usually do is that you can go and you can get permission to film, but you can get a police escort, basically. It's called a PDO or a pay duty officer here. But you literally go to the cops and you say, we're filming on the streets and we need to have a cop, and you pay for the cop, and the cop is there with you to make sure that there's no problems, mm-hmm. So that it's like, if you need to, because you may need to be moving a car in and out, or maybe you, often what we do is if there's a fight sequence or there's going to be a gun or something like that, you need to make sure that you have a police officer there so that people don't see somebody pulling out a gun or having a fight and they call the cops and then it becomes a problem. So we knew that we were going to be shooting on this busy street. And so we had a pay duty officer, which is like a London Bobby, and we were like right down the street from a police station. And it was so great because the cops are the nicest and the most amazing. And this guy that we had, I can't remember his name, but he was so great. And it was so funny because we were doing the sequence, so we had two actors dressed up as cops. And our real cop was over there standing there to make sure that everything was okay. But I had like the actors running across the street, and it was a pretty busy downtown London street. And we sort of started getting bold as it went along. And I, like our cops, our actors, were like running across and like stopping traffic, you know, and they're like literally stopping the traffic and rushing across the street. And it was like, and our cop was like, okay, all right, we'll let them do that. But it was like funny. We were running around like they were real cops. And then people, of course, would come up to them and ask them for stuff. And they're like, I don't know, I'm from Toronto or whatever. But it was like, it was quite amazing. It was like I felt like we were kids running around doing this stuff, like playing, you know. But it was on the day that we were shooting, we were right near a subway station. In that subway station on the same day, there was like this giant shoot, and it was the London version of Law and Order. And so it was like this big crew, right? So we were shooting the sequence, and we realized that we needed to make a little green screen on something that we were shooting. Like it was just like 4 inches by 4 inches that we needed a green screen, but we didn't have any green material. So it was like our production manager ran across the street to the subway station, ran down to the Law and Order set and said, do you guys, like, we're shooting this thing over here. Do you guys have any green tape that we could borrow? And they were amazing. The assistant was like, yeah, absolutely. And it was like, so he like gave us a roll of their green screen tape, and we came back and we used it and we green screened the thing, and it was great. But it was like, I loved that there was like this community feeling, you know, mm-hmm. that there we were, this tiny little crew shooting this little thing, and the Law and Order guys were like, yeah, take the green screen tape, man. You guys totally need this.
Yeah, those stories are always great, and they seem to, you know, stick more when you're in another culture and you're somewhere different, because it feels, you know, on a completely different subject, I was listening to this guy who was sailing around the world. He'd been around the world with his family twice, and their children were born, etc., while they were on the high seas. And somebody said to him, you know, aren't you worried about the pirates? You know, because that's the big thing that everybody who's doing that type of adventure gets concerned with. And it, rightfully so, there is an aspect of it out there. And this guy said, you know, I've been around the world twice. And the thing that I'll tell you is that if you're in the middle of nowhere and you're on a deserted beach and you're walking down and there's a person coming the other way towards you, the odds are they're going to help you. And I think that when you end up in other cultures, like when you're working like that and you're doing guerrilla stuff and doing stuff like on the fly, and you're relying on the good nature of human beings, they always, always step up and they always help. And that's the part that's, you know, so fascinating about being in those other cultures, I find.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's like in all the travels I've ever done, it's like 95% of the time people are just there for you, you know? And it's like, and you're genuine and you're try to be respectful and you try, you know, to do it as right as you can. And it's like people are amazing. Like people are genuinely amazing. And I have to say that you know, the French, I have a special connection with the French and working with the French. And it's like, the French are amazing. Like they consider content creation or filmmaking or whatever it is, storytelling, to be such an important and integral thing culturally that there's a genuine respect. You know, it's like here in Toronto, not that there isn't a respect, but it's like, you know, people see like a film shoot and it's just like, eh, you know, they honk their horn and it's like, get out of the way. And it's like, blah, 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 you're getting, you know, your stuff. I'm like, it's going to make me 10 seconds late for work or whatever. And it's like over there, it's like they think it's important what you're doing. You know, they actually think like this is, culture is an important thing. And it's like, you say you're making a film or you're making a series or whatever it is. And it's like, they're really like, oh my gosh, like they actually care and they want to help you. And it's like, yeah, I'll be happy to walk on the other side of the street or yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know, take your time, get the shot and I can wait. And it's really refreshing in a way, because it's like there's this respect for the cultural industries, you know, which I think mm-hmm. is different than a lot of other places, but I do I do really like that. And I don't know why I want to say that, but it's like, I feel like, you know, if you go when you're in a lot, when I've been in France, it's like people have, and you go and you say like, oh gee, like this is such a beautiful place. Can we film here? And they'll be like, yeah, come and film here and I'll bring some wine, you know?
Right. Yeah.
It's like, and we'll hang out and it's amazing. Yeah.
It's that respect for the arts, right? Yeah. You know, and then the creation of the arts. I mean, I used to joke about the fact that, you know, we used to do television commercials and you'd be in these places where you're using, you know, a location that's still open for business or whatever. And so you're having to figure things out and make it work. And so often people like, you know, you're making a television commercial and they would be willing to help you. So it was sort of an interesting concept because, you know, in North America is this sort of like, you know, commerce driven, consumption driven, you know, culture. Oh, it's something that's a commercial. It's something that is going to be seen on television as that. It's validated, but necessarily the student film or the art or the thing that maybe in France is validated here is seen as is maybe in a nuisance or seen here as something that, you know, like I remember that time we were shooting something for bike safety and we were filming bikes on the bike path and the bikes were yelling at us to get out of their way because they were in a hurry to get to work, right?
Yeah, I think about that all the time, actually. That's a story that comes to my mind all the time, is that it's like, I remember in particular, there's one cyclist who was like freaked out on us for being kind of in the way, like, and we were sort of a little bit in the way, but mostly it just meant that the cyclists had to kind of slow down a little bit, be a little bit cautious and kind of move around us. And like you said, we were shooting a bike safety video commissioned by people who are trying to promote bike safety. And it was like, and the cyclists are angry at us for inconvenience. And it was like, and it was one or two in particular, most I think were very gracious, but it's like, wow, like, come on, get over yourself, you know, like, and look at, I'm not saying that I don't fall into that trap sometimes, you know, and it's kind of like, oh, I don't need another film shoot blocking the thing and it's going to take me extra time and whatever. But like the fact is that like, I don't know, I think there's something to be said about why French culture thrives and maybe Canadian culture doesn't thrive quite as much. I don't know. Like maybe we need to be, you know, even within Canada, it's like French language culture thrives. I have a lot of friends, Francophone friends in the French language culture sector. And it's like, man, it's like there's this amazing desire to consume local content. And I don't think that exists quite as much in English Canada. You know, I think we can kind of take a little bit of a page from that, you know, mm-hmm. like be a little bit more passionate about what we're doing and maybe saying like, hey, this is actually important. Let's tell our own stories.
Right. Yeah. No, it is. It's a very important thing.
There we go. We bring it right back to Canada.
Right. Right back to home.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've been around the world and back to home.
Yeah.
Well, Jay, it's been really great listening to your stories of travel. You've taken me into some interesting places and some interesting location shoots. And I think that's the part that people love. They love to know, you know, what's behind the scenes in that type of creative process. And so thank you for sharing that.
It's my pleasure. Thanks. Thanks for talking with me. It's been great.
Great. Well, take care.
You too.
All right. Just before we go, I want to shout out Jay's touch point. The best place to see his stuff and connect with him is his website. And that's mira.studio, MIRA.studio. Well, that's another episode of Listen In. Thanks for being. Please subscribe, comment, or share, or follow us on Twitter or Instagram at Listen In Pod. That's Listen with two N's, Pod.